me here, bringing books to life. Vision without sight.
Elgi and the Galras. Book 1, The Essence Saga Series, by Colin Sinclair. Episode 2. Produced and dramatised by Be Here.
Chapter 6. Solora. Solora was hunkered down behind the bales of cloth, her whole body as relaxed as it could be, considering the predicament she was in. She was confident that they didn't know where she was. She had run swiftly through the twisting streets and had turned and doubled back as often as she could to ensure that they had not been able to follow her. Still, it was right to be cautious. The men following her seemed to have some kind of insight. On previous occasions, she had barely managed to escape them. They had an uncanny ability to track her down. She was, by any stretch of the imagination, a warrior of immense ability who was able to escape the most capable of trackers. She had been trained well, and by a very unusual source. Her mind turned inwards. She had been born 17 summers previous, and, as was the custom in the warrior tribe she belonged to, had been abandoned in the wild hours after her birth. She was left in a cave beyond the reach of all other humans to either thrive or die as the gods willed. Less than 1 in 100 survived the ordeal. For the first few days of her life, she had screamed, as babies do. She was hungry, tired, cold, but he had visited her. He had placed his hand on her and quieted her, staying for no more than a few minutes. But on his departure, she knew what she needed. She cried no more, and had, with the power of some basic understanding, used her mind to pull on the universal fabric and draw a cave lioness to her. From that animal, she had suckled and grown, and had learned the ways to hunt and track and become one with her surroundings. She had quickly become accepted by the pride as a whole, bending them to her will with her understanding of the basic nature of the fabric of the universe. 7 summers later, she left the pride and made the journey to return to her order. She had been welcomed back and took her rightful place among them as a trainee warrior. Even at that early stage, she knew she surpassed the leader in her abilities and understanding. She became known as Abreshemen, Voice of the God, though she preferred her name Solora, a name taken from the nightly sound of the cry of the cave lions. Before long, she left her tribe to discover her true calling. She sought the one who had given her life, the one who had shown her the path. A noise behind her alerted her. She snapped out of her thoughts and her body tightened, coiled, ready to answer any threat. It passed. Perhaps a rat scurrying through the bales looking for nesting material for food. She closed her eyes and extended her mind, gently probing her surroundings and stretching out down the alleyways and streets. Nothing. She could not feel them nearby. For the last week or so in this small city, she had felt that she was close to finding him. The sense of an impending meeting and the fact that her abilities seemed to sharpen day by day, as if they were being lent power by something else, confirmed her intuition. She eased with cat-like grace from her crouched position, her movements lithe and subtle, flowing like water over rounded stones, and with a fluidity that denied human constraint. She came to rest again at the corner of a junction and hunkered back down. It was then she felt the hand on her shoulder, and her mind shifted. She was transported to another plane, and in that instant, she knew she had found him. Or rather, he had found her. Her whole being felt like it had expanded to fill the universe, and she felt in touch with every living entity. Everything suddenly snapped back. She realized he had removed his hand, and then she looked up at him. Elgrid smiled at her, a smile so pure and wonderful it filled her whole being.
"You found me,"
she said.
"Come, follow me,"
he said as he walked past her. She followed without question. She looked at him again. He felt so familiar. But how could it be that she knew him after all this time? She knew who it was. She knew his purpose. And she knew it was him that had visited her when she was only a few hours old. How could that be?
"It's because I felt you,"
he said.
"Your soul cried out and I found you. When I touched you, I opened your mind and showed you what is possible. I knew that one day we'd meet again, that you would seek me out, and that together we could begin to strengthen our cause."
"How did you?"
she asked. He looked at her again. She saw his eyes shift from green to blue, and saw the whole of creation seated there. She was sure, for the first time in her life, that she was safe. She had found him, and her true journey would begin. He led her down a few twisting streets, and they came to a door adorned with the image of a brass coffee jar. It was decorated with mother-of-pearl handles and jade insets so that it glistened in the early morning sunlight. Elgrid pushed the door, and they entered through a small, low-ceilinged passageway and exited into a bright, plant-filled courtyard. The edges of the room were filled with coloured tasselled cushions and low wooden tables that were dotted around. Each table had silken cloths and small brass platters filled with liquid, upon which floated either bright open flowers or small sticks and yellow powder. Under the platters were small candles that kept the liquid warm and caused it to emit the smell of spices and the scent of exotic blooms. They sat at an empty table and settled back. A man appeared and asked their pleasure.
"Coffee, thick, spiced and black,"
Elgrid said.
"And could we please have some of those amazing cinnamon rolls and some cheese?"
Solora realized she was famished. It had been days since she had eaten, and now it was an option. Her stomach started to complain to her for lack of attention.
"The last time I saw you, as I said, was in the cave when you were but a few days old."
Solora took a deep breath, cast back into her mind, and began to tell her tale. She remembered awareness coming over her, and a man walking away, and knew that she had to reach out with her mind and get some help. A distress call came from her mind asking for food, and that thought stayed in her mind. She heard a soft padding and felt a rough tongue rubbing across her face. Then something soft surrounded her and lifted her up, twisting her around and placing her back down. Her face seemed to be surrounded by the same softness, and she could smell something sweet. Without having to think, her mouth sought out a nipple, and she suckled and tasted the fluid. She sucked harder and kept sucking, swallowing in gulps that filled her stomach. That was the start of her association with the cave lioness that had come and saved her life. Over the next few months, her vision cleared. She became stronger and was able to move and shuffle around. Her growth was prodigious, and what would normally take a human child months to accomplish, she managed in days, soon learning that she could stand on her legs, and then that she could shuffle along, and then walk. Soon she was following the lioness out of the cave and into the mountainous area that surrounded it, catching mice and other rodents, biting off their heads and devouring them in chunks. She grew stronger and quicker once this skill was achieved. "Months change into years," she told him, and with each passing day, she became more aware and was able to join the lioness on all her journeys ranging across the mountains. Sometimes they would see others of the lioness's kind, and sometimes other creatures that predated, but always she stayed hidden from their sight. They worked together as she grew, cornering larger and larger prey until she could hunt and bring down an adult mountain goat. She had learned to communicate with growls and noises, but she also had a connection with the wild beast through her mind, and they both knew what the other required. Time continued to pass. As each day went by, she became more sentient. Soon, a feeling settled in her mind, a feeling that was pulling her somewhere new, somewhere she knew her adoptive mother could not go.
I knew at that point I had to leave and head back to find others of my kind. The only thing I knew for sure was that there were others. But I didn't know where, so I thought I might start my search back at the cave. Once back at the cave, I followed what I thought was a path for a few days, and soon I came across a building and I hid. I spent the next few weeks living around the edge of the building. Soon I was able to see that they were clothed, and during the dark I managed to take the clothing that was suitable. But I continued to watch and listen. My mind easily grasped the language that people used, and I learned what seemed to be acceptable behavior. I practiced the sounds on my own at night. It was as I was sitting one night practicing the words that Draegar came. I hadn't heard him, and in the next moment he was standing in front of me. Draegar took me then, and together we wandered from building to village to city and back to village. As each day passed, he taught me what he knew. There is much to tell of how things happened and of places and people, but the tale is long and needs telling in its own time. As my seventh year came, Draegar took me back to where he said I had first entered the world, a warrior tribe of women living near the foot of the hills of the cave. He said I should go back and learn of my tribe and how they lived. It was evident to me that these people, though my ancestors, were primitive in their knowledge of the world and its practices. But I learned from them their use of weapons and their beliefs. It didn't take me long, and by my 16th year, I was ready to move on again. Something was driving me on. Of course, I know now that this was a calling to come and find you. I reached this city 2 weeks ago and sought to learn as much as I could. In the doing, I seemed to have stumbled across some men who were less than pleased I had disturbed their hideout. They chased me many times when I took food or drink from them. It became a game, and that's where I was when you found me, hiding after relinquishing them of yet more food.
She smiled and looked at him again. The coffee arrived, and along with it, the cinnamon rolls. The aroma was amazing. Elgrid poured the coffee, spooned some honey into the thick black liquid, and passed it to her. She sipped. Though it was hot, the taste exploded into her and filled her with what could only be described as pure pleasure. She could see that Elgrid was having the same experience. He laughed inside her head.
Amazing stuff, isn't it?
She hoped then that the rolls were going to bring the same experience, and they didn't entirely disappoint her. She thought that if she hadn't had the coffee first, these would have been amazing in their own right. They both fell silent and enjoyed the time of eating and drinking.
When you've finished, I have something to show you, and someone I'd like you to meet,
Elgrid said.
And I'm sure he will be delighted to meet you.
They sat for a while, drinking the coffee and eating. When they had finished, he stood, and she followed him again out onto the street. Her life was beginning. She knew it. She could taste the promise. Chapter 7. The Telling and Gathering of the 12. Framin sat and looked round the table. What he saw was, in essence, 12 versions of himself, all of them less in stature and with less power. Though he had taught each of them how to harness power from the fabric of the universe, they had been given only a glimpse. He had also taught a different use to each, dependent on the land and the people they belonged to. His power was beyond their understanding, but he felt it wise to ensure each was just a shadow of his strength. He knew how power bred greed, and he didn't want to give any of them the opportunity to think they could usurp him. He had been clever. These Gurong were the same 12 he had taken to his cause hundreds of years ago. But at different stages in time, he had let them go as if in death. He had renewed them again, wiping from them the ability to harness what they had learned beyond what he had taught them. In this way, he could ensure his dominance of the knowledge he held. The danger with giving beings power was that they lusted for more, and if they were clever enough, they could learn themselves. The last thing he needed was to have Gurong that had ambitions above their station. He had to have complete control over them. So far, with the exception of a few incidents over ambition, his plan had worked well. The balance was difficult. He needed them to have a relentless urge for power and destruction, but he needed them to understand the futility of challenging him. Each was staring at him as he took his seat. They had the look of men of power and men used to being obeyed. He had left them alone too long. He knew it. He could see on their faces that some of them had thoughts of usurping his position and installing themselves as the ultimate ruler. Now was the time to put a stop to that.
Before we eat and discuss what's to be done next, I have something to show you.
In front of each, an orb appeared, and in each orb, a vision of a woman and a child. To each of his Gurong, Fremen was showing them the wife and child he had ensured they each had. The women were strong and powerful looking, and each had a boy some 15 years old at her side. They were strong boys, regal and proud, living images of their fathers in stature and bearing. As the Gurong watched the images, they could see energies emerge and surround each of the boys. The fields of energy began to contract, and each of his minions could see fear on the faces of their offspring. They could see the mothers frantically calling for their retinues. The energies continued to contract. The boys' faces began to contort, and though they could hear nothing, they could see the screams in their minds. The lines of the energy field shifted and began to glow and burn, continuing to contract. Each line in the field sliced through the boys like hot knives through butter. Within seconds, all that remained of each boy was a charred pile of skin and bone. The mothers and their retinues stood stock still, aghast at the scene before them. The orbs snapped shut. Fremen took a moment to allow the vision to infiltrate the minds of his Gurong.
I needed you all to understand something fundamental. Each of you is given what I choose to give. Each of you has what you have by dint of my desire. That you contemplate taking my place has caused you to kill that which is yours, yet given by me. There is no future or past where you can usurp my will. If ever you think that you can challenge me, the same fate will befall all you have built and hold dear. I don't need you. I utilize you because it saves me energy. But I don't need you. Do I make myself clear?
At that, Fremen looked around the table, staring at each and ensuring that the fight had drained from them. A collective breath could be felt, and "Yes, Lord," was voiced by each. One by one they stood, placed hands on their chests, and with a twist of their hands they pulled their hearts from their bodies and held them towards him, a display of utter subjugation. He held them then, letting them weaken by this deed. They couldn't keep this up for long. He waved his hand then, giving them permission to return to life. Each sat, and though they had witnessed such a scene and had given him their allegiance, they still wore the bearing of those that would broker no interference in their plans. They were, in the end, ensnared by the power they had been given, and it controlled them like a drug.
Eat, and let us celebrate our victory.
They devoured the meat and vegetables placed on the table, as if they had not eaten in weeks. Ale was consumed, and cups were filled over and over, each of them subjecting themselves to gluttony of epic proportions. Framin sent out a call to Vianna, and the room filled with concubines of all shapes and sizes. Each of them carried ale, and along with it pipes of sweet-smelling opiates. The room began to fill with the essence of evil and debauchery. He left them, sure that they had returned to him in their entirety. From the corner of his eye, Bethrod saw Framin leave. He had moved himself away from everyone, and had made it seem like he was imbibing of the pleasure provided by their lord. Each of his brothers had given themselves to the darkness encompassed in the room. Bethrod, however, had more important tasks on his mind. For years he had fooled his lord and his brothers. He had learned to hide his true self and sent forth the vibrations needed to do so. He was smart. He had been smart hundreds of years ago, and in all that time he had increased his knowledge and his ability. Even during the cleansing ceremonies that Framin conducted, he had been able to hide his essence and continue his learning. In his experience, even those that confess themselves to be gods could be fooled, and his ambition, as far as he could tell, outstripped even this being. His brother Guarong had long since fallen to Framin's power, but it wasn't so in the beginning. Then he thought he might be able to influence their actions, and alliances had been brokered. He had long since given up on that road, though. They were weak and not as smart as him, and the hold that Framin had on them was too strong. He sent out a trace smaller than an atom to follow Framin. He had done this numerous times, and from it had learned untold secrets and truths. But at this crucial stage, he needed to learn everything he could. He knew that Framin was not a true being of this world, but was something else made up of the essence of the universe itself. He had watched as he decomposed his essence and mingled with that of the universe, and it was from that he learned this trick. Until now, he had not been able to follow Framin to learn his true origin, but he was getting closer, and that gave him hope. He still had time to learn more, and in that more he might discover the key that would give him the edge. So he let his trace go to call it and investigate it at a future time. It was, he had to admit, an epic undertaking that Framin had orchestrated. He had managed over centuries to gain a foothold in every corner of the globe and thus control tens of thousands of lives and vast resources. He had engineered his lattice of portals, each of them identical in construction, and each of them designed to garner life's energies. Bethrod looked round the room and at each of his brothers. Though they were almost identical in appearance, he could read their energy signatures and knew their differences. He decided he had had enough of the gathering, and leaving his human shell in the room, he slipped his true essence out and away from the present. He needed time to think and time to plan. He went over in his mind what he knew of these brothers. Cahilja's city was in a cold land. His people were hardy warriors, horse riders that roamed the plains. Apart from the city of Spires, there were few other permanent settlements. They were nomads, and set up camp wherever they decided to rest. The plains were interspersed with lakes of various sizes, some as big as seas, and others no bigger than a herd of the cattle. The seasons were mainly harsh and cold, with a brief summer that allowed the plains to seed. Honduras shared a continent with Calabar, Delam, and Santarish. It was vast and to the west. It had many climes, ranging from desert to mangroves to fertile terraces. Their population was numerous, comprised of small, industrious people who, encouraged by their lords, worshipped many gods of all shapes and sizes. Each of the gods, though, demanded sacrifices of livestock or humans. Prakaran ruled an area in a land that was green and lush, with rugged coastlines and soft rolling hills that were suited for the growing of grapes and olives. His people were scholars, but they also were fighters and fierce defenders of their lands. They relished the chance to discuss politics and alliances, and would defend those policies with their lives and armies. The country was ruled by a system of local, regional, and countrywide governing bodies. Prakaran had influence. Akima, Itsuo, and Kaidi each controlled a province amongst a nation that was made up of divided islands linked by traders who navigated the waters. The general populace was rigid and tradition-bound. An overarching emperor controlled the nation, but he'd had to make alliances to control the provinces, and, as such, each province could hold much sway. The three Gwurrung were plotting to destabilize and take the nation as a whole and insert one of themselves as emperor. Faisal and Bakir were tribal leaders of desert people and the hot, dry land to the north of Mehem. That land was ruled by Bremen, who was seen as a god made flesh. So the two had to be capable of conducting their business and schemes below his sight. They were sorely tested at all times. Bethrod himself held lands that were inhabited by a people that were raiders. They were a fierce, tall people that liked nothing better than a chance to sack and conquer new lands. Tribal in nature, they too were nomadic till they conquered a people. Then they put down roots, set up a ruler, and set about building new empires. They were, at the same time, bent on creating a peaceful empire. All their conquering was done in the name of coalescing disparate people and tribes into a mighty nation. Fremen did not see this. The killing, looting, and conquering suited his need. Bethrod had been careful to balance the greed in his people's nature and also fill them with the desire to sit at peace with each other. His nature, which was hidden, was to build something that benefited the whole. He needed to be sure, however, that his reach increased. He knew there would be a day of reckoning with Framin and his brothers, and he gathered his resources against that day. Was it enough? He wasn't sure. But alongside the power and vision that Framin had given him, he also heard another voice, a promise of eternal peace and joy that whispered to his soul, and he longed for that. He had taken a long time to work out where this desire came from. It tugged at him from time to time and appealed to his essence. He knew that things were gathering, like thunderclouds on the horizon. The time for different alliances and plans was coming. He just didn't know who or where they were. He was happy to ride each of these waves of thought and possibilities and see where they led. He knew there was more, much more than Framin had promised. He felt Framin return to the room, and with him came the trail he had sent. He gathered it in and would look later at what he knew. He returned to his earthly body and became alert.
Brothers,
came Framin's voice.
It's time to return and carry on with the plans we've taken so long to put in place. Things are moving now, and the universal lines are beginning to converge. Soon there'll be a reckoning, and we need to be ready. We'll have a chance to become what we deserve and desire. Make ready your plans. I'll visit each of you, and you can show me what you've accomplished.
Fremen again began his haunting chant, and his Gwurrung began to fade. As the last one disappeared from his view, he pushed a line of power that followed them all, and he sat to test his link. Chapter 8. Echancha. Echancha sat atop the rock and was at peace. Her energies ebbed and flowed to and from her centre, and she relished the feeling. It was cold on top of the mountain. Remnants of snow lay around in small pockets, blown by the wind against rock and into small hollows. But she hadn't felt it. She had tuned into the universal energies and had watched the goings-on of Framin and his Guarong. Some years earlier, she had discovered this ripple in the Earth's energies and had tuned in to watch what was happening. She had continued her vigil for many years now. She didn't understand what was happening or how it was happening, but she knew that there was something evil occurring, and she knew it was important. So she watched when she could, and she waited. Deep in her mind, she almost remembered something about herself. It was close, very close indeed. A few decades ago, she had found herself here, with no recollection of how or why it had happened. She waited for the day that someone would call to her. She knew it would come, but she didn't know from where or by whom. Until that point, she was prepared to wait, to watch, and to learn. Chapter 9. Bremen. Salora followed Elgrid through the narrow streets, not noticing the hustle and bustle increasing as they went. They arrived at an open square with multiple fountains and edged with eateries of all kinds. The sound of the running water soothed her. Since she had been with Elgrid, the city had not seemed so foreboding, and rather exuded a certain harmony. As she looked around, she could see many smiling faces. There didn't seem to be much dirt or rubbish, nor any people begging. The fountains were adorned with flowers and plants that added to the friendly ambience of the square. Fruit trees bearing dates, oranges, and a variety of persimmon were dotted around, and people took their leisure seated on the many small terraced areas, or standing around carts that were selling food and drink. Here and there, people were singing and playing instruments, while others were holding forth on miracles and lauding benefits provided by Bremen. Everywhere she looked, prosperity and calm abounded. Salora was, however, honed and trained to notice detail, and she saw here and there a person that seemed at odds with the surroundings, acting as if nothing was wrong, but they had attention that she could not miss. She touched Elgrid's arm and spoke to him.
Is there some kind of tension in the city? It's just that I noticed the odd person who seems to be out of place, like they're trying too hard to act normally.
Elgrid laughed.
Yes, you do well to spot them. There's a faction in the city that no matter how hard we try, we can't seem to eliminate entirely. They are followers of Framin. They come here to spy and report to him on what is happening. We try and corner them when we can and teach them the way that leads to light and hope. But Framin's training is deeply ingrained, and we do not get through to many. Those that we can't persuade, we send back to him.
You don't imprison them? Or kill them?
She asked.
No, we do not. It's against our nature to do such things. We cannot teach and talk about peace and the benefits of collaboration if we kill people or lock them up.
Elgrid smiled at her.
I have found,
she said,
that there are times that you have to fight for your own survival. Though killing something for the sake of it is something that's against my nature.
He looked at her again, as if weighing what to say next, but opted instead to say,
not too far now. Once we're there, we will have time to discuss these things, and you will see what we have planned. You will have no small part to play in this venture, and I suspect your nature will serve you well in the near future.
They came to the end of the square and moved up a short street. There in front of them was a building, the likes of which Salora had never seen. It was not vast and magnificent as she'd expected. In fact, it was quite humble in size. It did, though, draw her toward it, as though it were inviting her in, promising her rest and peace and happiness. It was a low-slung building, much wider than it was tall, and had a wide terrace that stretched the whole front of the building. Around the terrace were many seats and partitioned areas, split from others by rambling vines that created natural partitions. The stairs to the terrace were made of some kind of huge polished limestone, and she wondered how blocks had been moved. The building was made from the same stones, and it had low parapets along the front, each of them adorned with coloured glass that sparkled. Just beyond the parapets, she could see what appeared to be the top half of a giant ball. Many people sat around on the terrace, talking and enjoying the chance to pass the day with each other. There did not seem to be any guards, and as they approached the building, no one seemed to notice or care that they were heading for the opening. They crossed the terrace and headed toward a pair of oak doors, plain to look at, but nonetheless thick and sturdy, with ornate carvings and brass studs on each door. As they passed the threshold, Solora felt the hairs on her arms and neck stand up, not in a fashion that related to danger, but as if someone had blown a gentle breeze across her skin. She stopped and looked back.
"No one may enter who has any malice in them,"
Elgrid said.
"I would say that right now we're in one of the safest places I know."
She turned back and they continued to walk. The air inside was cool, yet warm enough. Light poured in through the terrace, and the coloured windows cast shades and shapes in every direction. It held an almost mystical quietness that seeped into the body, spreading a further feeling of belonging. There was little to show any opulence, and the decor was modest, functional, yet beautiful at the same time. No showing of wealth with gold or jewels, but decor that made her feel at home and welcome. An earthy quality about the place held a suggestion that it was a part of something much more grand. Everything had a connection to everything else, and each had its place and purpose. They walked towards a wall that was covered with arched entrances, portal-like in their appearance, each one inviting discovery of what lay beyond. Elgrid steered them to an opening in the centre, and they passed through into a circular room. Books and manuscripts covered the walls and stretched up to the vaulted circular ceiling. Several balconies ran around the room in concentric circles that led her eyes toward the centre of the ceiling, which was spectacular in that it opened to the heavens. She could see stars and planets and moons, and lines connected them in all directions. It was mesmerizing. Toward the back of the room and seated around a wooden desk were two people. Solora stopped then. In front of her was the most beautiful woman she had ever seen. She stood, clothed in shifts of cloth that were almost transparent and floated around her, leaving everything yet nothing to the imagination. Her body was lithe yet seductive in its roundness, her legs slim and long yet muscular in nature. Her hair was raven and fell across her shoulders and down her back, opulent in its richness. Her face was breathtaking in its beauty, with a bone structure that showed off every angle and feature, all of which complemented the other. She turned her gaze to Solora, and in an instant, Solora knew here was a woman that knew her soul. Indeed, the reason for her very existence. It was disquieting yet soothing at the same time. Next to the woman was a young man, the same age as Solora. Broad-shouldered, yet not too tall. His head was covered in unruly straw-gold hair that fit his face. Square-jawed and strong-featured, his eyes held a kindness and understanding well beyond his years. Solora felt a tug unlike anything she had felt before, an almost primal urge to touch this man for him to touch her. She wasn't sure of her next step. That spell was broken when the woman, who identified herself as Chirina, spoke.
"Come, Solora. Come and meet Bremen."
She smiled as she spoke.
"Let us get to know each other and talk of the future. There will be time for your feelings soon. I can tell you, though, that they were meant to be. They come as no surprise to anyone here other than you, and I suspect Bremen himself."
She laughed. It was clear, strong, and sang out to them all. It even tasted of joy.
"Don't tease them so, Chirina,"
Helgrid said.
"I thought we'd agreed that we would talk of this as things progressed."
"It is clear to me that there won't need to be much talking for these two to know that they are each half of the other. They have already felt it. It is written on their faces.
The joy it brought her was again infectious, and they all stood, facing each other and smiling, as if a meeting of long-time lovers, those that understood each other deeply, whose souls had travelled together across eternity. There would be no secrets here. Bremen was stunned. Trina had told him Elgrid was bringing someone to meet him, but he was unprepared for the reaction he had the moment he saw Solura. At first, he thought that Elgrid had brought with him a lioness, but that was nonsense. She was walking on two legs, though her hair was golden like that of a lioness. She flowed as she walked, exuding a prowess that was both regal and dangerous. Her eyes were also golden and glinted as she looked around. He'd thought that Chirina was the most beautiful woman he had ever seen, but he was wrong. She stood before him now. He felt a tug and wanted to gather her up, but he stood fast.
Bremen, meet Solura, or Abreshiman, as her people call her. Solura, meet Bremen.
Elgrid and Chirina backed away and left them both standing, watching each other. Solura spoke first.
I don't like and have never liked the use of Abreshiman, so Solura will do.
I'm Bremen, Solura, and I give myself to you completely. All essence that I have is yours to take and share and do with as you please.
He leant in even closer and kissed her softly.
Your essence I take,
she said, pulling away.
And in return, I give you that which you will take from me.
Bremen untangled himself and took her by the hand. He led her towards an opening, leading to a balcony that overlooked a large courtyard in the centre of the building. It was beautiful, filled with flowers and plants and a running stream. He held her again and began to speak.
It seems like I've waited for you all my short life, but I didn't know that I was doing it. I have a feeling that somehow you have completed me, and now I seem to be more at peace. I feel the need to tell you all about myself. I've lived here all my life. My father was Bremen before me, and Elgrid showed him ways to try and reconcile our people. He made great strides, and the city has become a place of safety, of learning, and of the telling of tales that will make the world understand the benefit of the things we do. Since I was a small child, I've been talking to people of how to become one with the energies of the world, how it benefits them, and how kindness, compassion, forgiveness, and most of all love, can overcome everything. Until now, though, I hadn't realized that there was a different depth to love. Love that could be kept only for two, not shared amongst everyone. I have learned today, on meeting you, that even more than I imagined may be possible. This love I feel right now can be used to show even greater things to everyone. Elgrid talked to me about the need to feed your own soul with love and then share it. I thought I had that in the love of the people, but now I know I was limiting myself in that knowledge. I have much that I want to share with you, much that I would like to tell you and show you. Will you let me? Will you let me share what I know? Will you share with me what you know, and we can build something amazing? Something wonderful for everyone.
I will gladly let you share everything with me. And in return, I will share my story with you. I am not sure what this is, but I am sure it's the beginning of something. The beginning of something that I need.
Be here. Bringing books to life. Vision without sight.